one of those white teeth smiles that lit up his dark-skinned face and nodded. "Don't tell me much."
"Spare a penny, Governor?"
The youngster had emerged from behind a gravestone to beg. The first thing obvious that he'd been crying at some time. There were clean streaks on his otherwise filthy face and a trace of blood, which had crusted the bottom of his nose. A second dwarf edged out from the headstone to be visible, he showing a mass of bruises on his face.
"Who's been troubling you, lad?" asked Dutchy, who, with nippers of his own, was of a more charitable bent than the others. Also, with that warm and rolling West Country accent, he did not sound threatening.
"Nobody,"
was the automatic reply from the first one. But his battered mate was less reticent.
"Fell afoul of John Auger, we did."
"That sod again,"
Peddler swore as Streaky Face berated his mate to shut your gob.
"Sling your hook,"
Cocky snapped.
"The pair of you. I'm no paying for your gin. God, you stink of it. Promise not to dog you, if you go to a sixpence."
Dutchy put a hand on Cocky's chest to stop him swearing at them.
"What do you mean by that, lad?"
"Don't tell him,"
spat Streaky Face.
"Auger paid us to watch where you was going, and we did."
"And you told him?"
"Promised a flask we were. Annie was as good as his word, excepting Danny, who was to look out for you last night. Fell asleep, and he came looking for him this morning. Couldn't catch him, though, but he nabbed us asleep. Auger don't know that about Danny, mind, so don't you go letting on."
"Captain,"
Dutchy called, "best you come over here."
The thought obviously did not go down well with these two urchins, and they looked to sidle off. Dutchy grabbed them both by their rags, telling Joe to catch hold too. Brazier sauntered over to cast a jaundiced eye at these two brats as Dutchy said,
"Now tell him what you just told me, and I will reckon it to be worth a shilling."
All five were back at the Navy Yard long before dinner, no more needing to be said than that which had made up their conversation on the way from the graveyard. It was agreed they'd been lucky, for there was no doubt if they'd been in the house it would have led to serious injuries and possibly a lot worse. Any residual doubt about who had set the mob on them, and there wasn't much, disappeared. Now, with a quartet sat on some bollards looking out at HMS Bellerophon, and the people working on her deck and rigging, it was no great stretch to conclude Tulkington and Hawker were unlikely to let matters rest. The next question to arise was obvious. What to do about the ongoing threat? Brazier had stayed standing. Familiarity with these men was fine in private, but here, where they could be seen, a post-captain did not sit jawing with common seamen. Now he began to pace about.
"I'm not minded to run away."
"Never thought you would be,"
Peddler said it. All by their expressions established they agreed.
"This is a private quarrel, lads, to do with my own hopes, not yours."
"Was,"
Dutchy growled.
"Not much like to forgive some bugger who'd see me dead, Captain."
Brazier had no need to explain. But he did so anyway. The whole thing had arisen because of his pursuit of Betsy. And if they had been recruited to join him for protection, he had not known the true extent of what they would face.
"So it's my fight, not yours."
"Is that no the same as private quarrel?"
Cocky looked to the others for agreement, quickly forthcoming, to then turn back to Brazier with a querying expression.
"Nor like you to repeat yourself, sir."
"So we agree. The chances of their having failed means them trying again."
"Certain," Joe Lascelles said. "And if it were me, I'd be looking to kill now, not maim." That came with a throat-slitting hand gesture. "Sefer that way."
"So it's run or fight, but I can't ask you to take part if it's the latter. My only aim is to get my lady out of Cottington Court. That done, I have nothing else to seek, and not revenge."
"Where you go, Your Honour, we go. Right, lads?"
"Spot on, Dutchy," said Peddler Palmer.
"Near bother,"
came from Cocky.
Joe just smiled.
"So what now?"
Dutchy asked.
"Eat, Then I think I've got to try and find that Daisy Trotter.
Cocky put a hand to his hip to make a teapot arm. You can wait a look.
I'll settle for leaving a message. The other thing is where to get hold of some muskets. Can't be in Deal if we're being watched.
Looks like we're in for a serious fight.
Maybe you're right, Dutchie, and it's one I can't lose. Though I'm hoping a threat will suffice. Now, let's go to dinner.
For him, that was in the main dining room of Admiralty House, where he would mingle with the officers based in Deal and be queried about his past exploits. Dutchie, Cocky, Joe, and Peddler messed in a hall at the kind of tables they were accustomed to, and were soon swapping tales with men who, like them, had been at sea for years. A few, now, too old for that kind of service. Chapter 28. The obvious place to buy weapons was Dover. Every port in the land had a gun shop, but those that harboured a lot of merchant vessels, who required them for protection from piracy, would be the busiest. The notion of borrowing them from the navy yard had been mooted, but dismissed. There was no way of knowing what was going to happen. The knowledge that Brazier and his men had such weapons rarely used on land by anyone other than the military would be like a pointed finger at them being the culprits. Even purchasing in Dover required time to get there and a degree of subterfuge, added to a cock and bull story about a ship on the way down from London, first tested in a Chandler's Emporium buying rope and grappling irons. This invented ship would be picking them up for a scientific expedition to the South Seas. They, being Brazier and Dutchie, though false names were used. Gun oil was purchased too, and material for swabbing the weapons, bought in at the next stop and with the same tale. Not that it seemed the gun shop owner was that bothered. A dry stick of a fellow with a face that reminded Brazier of a day-old cadaver, he was more interested in getting a good price. He would tell his friends that evening about the two boobies he'd had in his works who'd paid way over the odds for weapons, 4.56-inch Brown Bess muskets which he'd bought from the local fencibles.
"Barrels so worn they're as big as a cow's arse. Doubt the bulls they purchased also will come close to a fit. A lot to steer clear of, I say. Good powder they got, mind. Faberstrom's best."
The four men who would use them had fired muskets before, but not of that length. The sea service version, much shorter to avoid snagging the rigging in a fight, was also easier to load, the ram being shorter. But it was not a favoured weapon, whatever its size. A musket handed out before a battle was never likely to have anything approaching accuracy over 50 yards, and sometimes a lot less than that. The Marines had the most effective weapons, for they cast their own lead balls to fit a barrel they would keep for years, replacing the stock if that got worn. Thus, their balls came out of the muzzle straight, which gave them some hope of hitting a target. An ill-fitting ball, being loose, would not only lack velocity, it could go anywhere. They had to be sneaked in and out of the navy yard the next day, wrapped in canvas to conceal them from prying eyes, then taken to the woods near the village of Ringwald, where, in the trees, the sounds of shots could be people hunting rabbits. Then it was load, ram, prime, and fire several times until his quartet could be sure of letting fly with them as a group, if not being sure to hit anything. He would be wanting them to frighten anyway, not maim. It was an accident that in cleaning the barrels, first with water and then with gun oil, necessary after the day's practice, they were caught doing so by the yard's master-at-arms. He was on his rounds as the man responsible for ensuring the tallow wads, which would be needed at night, were fit to last. He came into the barracks in which they'd been accommodated, empty during the day as the personnel who used it went about their tasks. Quite rightly, he asked what they were about.
"Captain's keen on hunting rabbits."
That sounded as feeble to Dutchie as it did to the man on the receiving end, judging by the look he produced. But these four were not on the muster, so he was obliged to accept what they said, though he did mention it to the officer of the watch, not that he seemed overly concerned.
tempted to tell the Master-at-Arms there might be things he would not want to hear about Captain Edward Brazier. He decided to keep his peace. It would never do to denigrate a fellow officer with one of petty rank. Brazier had ridden out to Cottington, though going nowhere near the front gate. He had no need to be told where was north, and that was the one he wished to examine. He took his rented mare, Bonnie, past the stud paddocks, having trouble keeping her head in the direction he wanted as she sought to show off to the other horses. It was tail out like a stiff pennant and her stepping high and boastful. Curiosity brought those inside the fences to look, smell and whinny. Upton had told him the gate was kept locked, unless in use, when it was opened on the inside and locked with the same padlock and chain on the outside. In his buff-coloured coat and his hat pulled low, he rode along the high brick wall, thinking how helpful it would have been to see over. But he'd been inside Cottington before, and so he had some idea of what they would face. Mostly woodland. Grappling irons would be used to get over and undo the padlock, the gate left open for a quick exit, with Joe Lascelles as the man to close and lock it once the others and their mounts came through. He being no man for a horse and damn near impossible to see at night in dark clothing. He would make his way back to Deal on foot. His orders were to go to the Three Kings, where a room would be booked for Betsy. Not that her name would be used. There had to be more than one key to that padlock and means, a ladder perhaps to get from inside to out. But the period to fetch it and get the gate open again must be measured in a good part of an hour. Plenty of time for the main party to get well away. All that was needed was a mount for Betsy, and that came from Vincent Flaherty, a pony she had hired before and was fond of.
"Now why would you be wanting Canaster?"
"Am I required to say?"
"I suppose not, Edward, as long as you pay."
"I'll be stabling him at the Navy Yard for a few days."
"Right. When Saoirse asks where he is, I'll say you've got him."
Seeing the look of inquiry, he added,
"Did you not know, since you've taken Bonnie, it's her favourite?"
"No." A recollection came then of his first days in Deal, when he had rented Bonnie from Flaherty. He had met him later in the Lower Valley Road, and Vincent, a friendly sort with an easy manner, had taken him to the old playhouse for the first time. That led to an introduction to Saoirse, while Brazier had been able to observe how enamoured of her Vincent was. He was a man clever enough to do addition.
"Vincent, I would not want my having this pony broadcast."
"Lips sealed, Edward."
Was not wholly convincing, but that could just be his way of ever being jocose. Back at the Navy Yard, he told his lads,
"All we need now is a night with a bit of moon."
"Not full, cabin."
"No. A half or less will do."
Too much was like daylight. None at all, and it would be too dark to see anything. And there was one more string he might be able to add to his bow, but that had yet to materialize.
"Why have we brought that wretch back, Henry? I'm doing my very best to get Elizabeth to accept her situation, and you throw this in her face. All my efforts will be undone when she finds out."
"I have my reasons, Aunt Sarah, and I do not see the need to explain them to you." Seeing her puff up to respond, he raised his voice. "And, I will add, you have tested my patience quite enough these last few days, and I will not have it so again. I would remind you that you depend on my charity. Don't give me grounds to withdraw it." Sarah Lovell exited with as much dignity as she could muster, her back so stiff it was designed to send a message to her nephew she was unbowed. It was not replicated in her face, which registered her lately found position of advantage was no more. She was back to being merely useful. Henry was left working out how to play the game he'd decided upon, namely that he would use Spafford to threaten Elizabeth. Misbehave, and he would allow the scrub to ravish her, as was his conjugal right. She might fight, but she was a woman, and if Spafford was a weakling, he was also proven randy. kept here and denied his daily diet of whores, to then be offered a delicious flower like his sister, whom even Henry acknowledged as physically beautiful, and the man would be like a slavering wolf. Fight she might, but succumb she would, in an imagined scenario that occasioned him some quite pleasant discomfort. He was tempted to encourage it anyway, just for the pleasure to be had from her distress, a payback for years of ridicule. But that was to sacrifice an advantage, which would be foolish. But she must be told what she risked, and he must be primed. On the night, should it come about, a drop of brandy and an offer of her body would surely do the trick. With Hawker back, he would go and see him on the morrow, to remind him of who deferred to whom. Elizabeth could keep her door locked for one more day, and she would, for their aunt was bound to tell her who was a few doors away. Daisy Trotter was not one to enter Deal on a regular basis, but when he did, Basil's Molly House was his port of call, a place where he knew everybody, and given they were like souls, was never thought different for his tastes. He always hoped for a few ships fresh in, and some of the younger crew members having a run ashore looking for the right company willing to part with a bit of coin for Congress. When he was passed the message that a certain naval captain, no name given though everyone knew it, wanted him to call at the Navy Yard, he was a bit more than thrown.
"Lucky you, Daisy," squealed Basil the Bulger, truly born in Dover,
with a loose-waved wrist that did nothing to enhance his fat-lipped, round and rouged old face.
"If you can bed that one, you'll be in paradise."
"Not the type for me, Basil. Too airy. Now I need someone to write a note for me."
Out at Worth, Dan Spafford might be planning a run, and short of coin it would have to involve some thieving. But he only had half a mind on it, what with fretting about Harry. Was he at Cottington or not? And if yes, could he be got out without them having a repeat of what had gone before? Daisy, fed up with the same litany, had not just let Dan rant on. He said it to him plain that the boy was not worth a bit of his spit, which had seen Daisy taken by the throat and half pushed up a wall until he was struggling for breath. In all the years he and Dan had berthed together, there'd never been a hand laid on him, and they'd had disputes, some shouted ones, but his lifetime shipmate could not take the criticism of Harry. And now they didn't talk at all. Daisy was lucky to get a glare. If Brazier wanted a meet, and it would have to be here, there might be something in it to make things good again, but he knew he would have to have a care. Any notion he might have known about what was coming to Quebec House, though he'd never thought murder was part of it, would have to be avoided. Brazier was dining with the officers when the note was delivered, listening to a marine captain drone on about his proficiency with the violin, which made it a doubly good reason to make his excuses and leave. As was ever the case, as soon as he went through the door, he became the main subject of conversation, generally held to be an odd cove, and of course, since he was absent, they could probe each other for any fresh gossip on the cloud he was rumoured to be under. "If the fellows he has with him are anything like a clue, he's more than strange. The Lord only knows what they're planning to do with a set of army muskets." A babble of queries meant that had to be explained. The master-at-arms had come across them cleaning their weapons, which left the speaker with a quandary. "Do you think I should tell Admiral Braddock?"
"Best to cover your back, I say," opined the boring violinist.
"There must be somewhere else we can talk, Trotter. This place feels as though the walls have ears."
"No need to be uncomfortable, Captain,"
came with a knowing smile.
"You're safe here."
What Basil called his palace of delight was far from full, yet felt cramped. This was just as well. Crowded, the brick walls ran with human perspiration. Daisy was not to be moved. He felt safe here, but he did ask Basil if he could use his upstairs bedroom, a place so garishly decorated it looked like a seraglio. That was just as much a curiosity as down below, with so many people being obvious about what was usually hidden. It wasn't that Brazy had never encountered such a thing before. It existed in a small way in the service, and not always just on the lower deck. But the imperative for officers was to turn a blind eye as long as it was not thrown in their face. The efficient working of the ship was paramount.
Is young Spafford at Cottington?
Brazier asked.
Don't know, and it's driving my Dan to a frazzle wandering.
What would your Dan say, assuming he is there, if I offered to get him free?
He'd bite your hand off, but why would you?
He has something I want.
That really pricked his interest.
I'm going to tell you a tale you'll scarce believe, and I want you to know it's one I want kept discreet. Tell no one you don't have to, on pain of meeting my sword.
The knife was out in a flash, a long, thin, silver blade which had Brazier move back in haste.
Don't reckon me easy quarry. Yours wouldn't be the first gut I've filleted. Now tell me your tale, and I'll decide if it goes any further.
This trotter was very different from the one he'd met previously, but that did not alter the fact of what he wanted done. So he told him of what he'd missed that night he'd lain doggo in the grass, which was a way of also telling him why Brazier had been there. The shock was total.
Harry, wed to a Tulkington?
Despite me, yes. But it was forced upon her and needs to be annulled. I will undertake to get Harry free from Cottington. In turn, he will swear on oath that the woman to whom he was wed was coerced and probably drugged. He will swear this was done at the behest of her brother, and that the ceremony was a farce carried out by an ill-named reverend called Moyle.
So you can wed her yourself?
A nod.
You'll be going there to snatch her away, then?
I will, and as soon as I have the right kind of moon. So there's no time for any to and fro. Put it to Spafford and get me his promise that I will get what I want. Then he can have what he wants.
Daisy dropped his head so as not to meet Brazier's eye. He was thinking. And the blessing was that the man with him reckoned him to be doing just that. But the purpose was different. Harry would never pass up being married to a rich beauty, no matter what his pa tried to get him to do. But if he could take to Dan the news of what was being offered, happen they could get back on good terms.
I need to know how you're going to do what you say.
I take it my word will not suffice.
T'other way round, would it then?
So that had to be imparted, for Daisy had the right of it. He told him of how they'd got the key and what had happened to the bearer, at which point Daisy had to again drop his head. Brazier explained he would once more put a pistol to Tulkington unless Betsy was brought out. If Harry Spafford was there, he would be brought out as well, willing or not.
I'm taking my men in, armed with enough threat to subdue. No one is going to get hurt.
Not even Tulkington.
Brazier shook his head.
Tempted as I am. But I need an answer and quick.
That took some thought.
I'll try to come back here tomorrow evening, if not the night after.
Fine. I'll have someone keep a watch for you.
One thing.
Which is?
You don't seem to care much about what Tulkington does for his wealth.
It's none of my business. So if you're one of those people who thinks I'm in league with William Pitt, you're mistaken. I have only one interest where he is concerned, and that is to take his sister away from him.
Won't have it, Captain Brazier. If anyone's going to get Harry free, it has to be Dan himself. What he's saying is, he will come along.
Alone?
Never in life. It'll be all.
It's not needed. All we're going to face is Tulkington and his servants, and they're not fighters, barring a couple of coachmen, perhaps. We'll be in and out in a blink.
And what if he don't just want Harry? The way Tulkington treated him needs paying back.
He said that.
When Daisy nodded, Brazier was forced to think.
Did it really make that much difference?
If Dan Spafford wanted to revenge himself on Henry Tulkington, what was it to him? As long as he got what he needed from his son.
Will I get Harry's sworn testimony?
Dan will lock him up till he agrees.
Harry, with no drink for a week, would sign away the crown jewels.
Very well. Tell me how to get to where you reside, and I will tell you what time we will come.
Chapter 29. The first night Harry Spafford was back in Cottington Court was the time at which Betsy determined to arm herself. There were guns in the house left over from her father's time, he, unlike Henry, being a keen hunter of woodcock and pheasants. She had no idea where they were stored, and, even more tellingly, no notion of how to load them, always assuming she could also find the shot. During the day, she was careful to avoid any meeting with him, in this aided by her aunt. He was not one to rise early. Indeed, the morning seemed alien to his nature, so she could undertake her walks and be back and out of sight before he called for sustenance. All her meals she took in her room, and, like her food, the means to carry out a daily toilet came from the servants fetching hot water. Refuge was found in reading, Sarah Lovell fetching the means to do so from the library. The mood swings of this purveyor were a mystery, and would remain so given inquiry was clearly not welcome. So ebullient and confident for a few days, her aunt seemed to have shrunk back into submissiveness with the arrival of Spafford. She had, though, managed to convey, albeit elliptically, that he was present as a threat to ensure her compliance with her brother's wishes, one that had no need to be elaborated upon. A knife was the only viable option, and it was necessary to wait until the entire house was asleep before attempting to secure one. On a cloudy night, the house was in near Stygian darkness, so only long familiarity with both the layout and the furnishings allowed her to make her way down the stairs and through to the kitchen. Even there, it was only memory from long ago that served her needs. As a child, she'd often come here for food and milk, but not as an adult. So it took, through touch alone, a long time to find the wooden block in which the sharpest utensils were stored. And that could not be achieved without some noise. Every incident of bumping into or knocking something had her freeze, heart thumping, listening for a reaction. Even when she found the block, it was a case of feeling for the kind of pointed implement that would serve to stab. One located, and it came close when she felt it, to cutting her own flesh. It was just as difficult to leave as it had been to come. She was feeling her way along the large table on which food was prepared and at which the staff ate, when the door to Grady's pantry opened. The lantern he was holding illuminated the room, leaving her standing stock still, knife in hand, and, Betsy was sure, easily visible. Nothing was said. They merely looked at each other until Grady's eyes dropped a fraction, obviously to what was in her hand, which on its blade was reflecting the light. About to speak, Betsy could not find the words she wanted to say. How could she explain to him the purpose of such a weapon? It turned out to be unnecessary. Silently, Grady nodded and shut his door, which told her he understood, and probably approved. Back in her room, and that took just as long to get to as it had going to the kitchen, Betsy sat on her bed by dim candlelight. She began trembling, in sharp contrast to the steadiness she'd shown when setting out. Finally, that subsided enough for her to undertake the next step, which was to hide it, where none of the servants who cleaned the room could find it. She was not to know that come morning, when the cook noticed one of her knives was missing, Grady told her she was not to mention it to anyone, and especially not to the master. Thus the house went through its own daily rhythms without disturbance, Betsy with her toilet, her tray of food and her walk, knowing she was being trailed. Henry had his usual shave from Grady, followed by breakfast in the company of his aunt. She, no longer as talkative, and certainly not as assertive, as of late. After some time in his study, he went off in the coach to whatever business he was dealing with that day, so it would have been hard for anyone to know there was any difference to any other. And then Harry Spafford woke from his slumbers and began to demand the kind of endless attention that set everyone's nerves on edge. On hearing his shouts through her locked door, he was not content to summon with a bell. Betsy found it hard to concentrate on the book she was reading, and had to constantly feel for the knife which would spend its nights under her pillow, and its days close to her hand. Henry came away from his meeting with John Hawker, sure he'd got the point across, without causing too much damage to the man's self-esteem. He could not help but silently reprise the words he had used, to examine them for any possible hurt, and was satisfied there could be none. For once, there was no turned back and hand warming at the stove. It was direct contact, eye to eye, as much for Hawker's sake as to gauge his reactions.
"If there are things I don't tell you, John, it is because you do not need to know. It is not that I don't trust you, it is that I have no need to explain. If I did not tell you what transpired from my first meeting with Spafford, it was because I was unsure of how matters would play out." An expressionless face could be taken in various ways, and Hawker wore one. Was it stony anger or cold calculation, listening and assessing? Only one conclusion was possible. He was not going to give anything away, and that was not something to be concerned about.
"You disagreed with me about how to deal with Spafford, and that I cannot have. It is not a lack of respect for you, but the need for there to be one controlling head running things. It cannot be done by debate, as I'm sure you understand." That got a jerk of the head, more than a nod. "Good. Now let us carry on as we should, to mutual profit."
Henry had sent his carriage ahead to wait at the lodge, and unusually for him, he was to be seen walking through the town, where he acknowledged the nods of acquaintances and studiously ignored those from folk barely known to him, who would, if he engaged with them, be either pleading for something or merely grovelingly obsequious. There were many too cautious to even make eye contact, and that was pleasant, to a man who cared as much to be feared as respected.
"Mr. Cremins, I find you well."
A carter in a small way, indeed a small man with cropped hair and worn features, Cremins was surprised to see in his yard a man like Tulkington. He was of the kind who barely stooped to even nod from within his coach. That induced a sort of half-bow, half-crouch as he sought to demonstrate his deference.
"Is trade good?"
Henry continued. "Passable, Your Honour. No more, if I may make so bold. Some folk are hard to match in prices charged for carting."
"Quite. Would it be of interest to you if I was to put a bit of trade your way? Shifting my farming produce, perhaps?"
"Why, sir, I'd be more than grateful."
"I trust the price would be competitive."
Cremins knew Sowerby transported the Tulkington goods, and, Henry thought, also knew what they consisted of, though he would never let on.
"If that was so, it might lead to more business."
"If I was to match your present tariff, Mr. Tulkington, would that serve?"
"Mr. Cremins, how could it not be? I will be in touch when we are ready to shift crops. You have my word on it."
As he left, he made a mental note to tell John Hawker that Cremins was to be left alone from now on. He would no longer be required to pay so that his business ran smoothly and free from trouble. Sowerby would soon hear of what was coming, and it would be of interest to see how he reacted. Whatever, it would send the required message. The family that raised you to prosperity can just as easily bring you down. 2 days of cloudy weather, the result of a brisk westerly wind, occasioned deep frustration for Edward Brazier. With communication thought to be unwise, it could only be hoped what had been arranged with Trotter would hold. The others, more stoical, seemed to be less troubled, which he put down to their being the kind of seamen for whom decisions outside their daily tasks were made for them. Inactivity, which made him nearly physically itch, was taken as normal. He had another dinner with Braddock, though it was relieved by the presence of others. One of the main topics of conversation, the news from France, of the travails of King Louis, as he tried to deal with the bankruptcy of the country.
while all welcomed the French having troubles, there was yet a lingering professional disquiet. It was a country that could scarce go to war in its present state, which meant a lack of opportunity for those eating at Braddock's board. Another cloudy night was spent at the old playhouse drinking with Flaherty, though in a more abstemious fashion than previously, occasionally joined by Saoirse, with Brazier watching the pair carefully to see if they were harbouring information he did not wish them to share. It was on his way back to the Navy Yard that he felt the change in the wind, the westerly swinging round to, he hoped, the northeast, which would bring clear skies, and with it, a half moon. Having gone to bed hopeful, he awoke to a sunny morning and the sure knowledge that if it held, he would be going to rescue Betsy tonight. Total avoidance proved impossible, and unusually, Spafford had risen early enough to catch Betsy on the stairs as she came back from her walk. Unknown to her, his consumption of drink had been severely curtailed by her brother, which rendered his morning head much clearer. He was standing on the landing, an infuriatingly superior smile on his face, while he looked like he was not going to budge to let her pass. The knife, which went where she went, was wrapped in a muffler she had declined over the last couple of days to let Grady take with her cloak. Sarah Lovell, having seen to her return, was still in the hallway when the first words were exchanged, and on hearing them she hurried to fetch her nephew.
"Get out of my way."
"Is that the right manner in which to address your husband? You are no more my husband than that newel post by which you're standing. Do you not miss what you had with your Stephen?"
When she looked angry, he added, still smiling,
"Henry told me all about him. Sounds rather pathetic to me, so happen I could bring you to that which he would have struggled to provide. In my company, your screams would wake the house."
The knife came out to be pointed at him.
"It will be your screams, Spafford, for your spilt guts if you come anywhere near me. Now let me pass so I can go to my room, unless that is what you wish for now."
"Elizabeth?" Henry's voice did not cause her to turn round. Her more pressing enemy was still before her, and it was he who spoke. His tone jocular.
"She's threatening to stab me, Henry. I must say you've found me the most spirited wife. Bending her to my will should be a pleasure. My body even more so."
"Go to your room, Harry."
"Ah, my silken prison."
"Do it," was sharply delivered, not there to brook an argument. Spafford pulled a face and did as he was bid. As Betsy made to move, Henry spoke again. "I think that knife be best handed over to me, Elizabeth." She spun round and glared at him, a look that encompassed Sarah Lovell, who stood alongside him.
"Come close, and it will be you who feels it."
"I don't doubt you mean that, and I fear your dear aunt would not be safe from your ravings, so I will send a couple of people from the stables to take it off you. I doubt you'll stab a servant, you're too fond of the breed. If they fail to do so, they will pay the price of dismissal."
"You bastard!"
got Lovell hands to the Lovell lips in shock. On Henry it had little effect. "A category not unknown in our family. But I'm not one of them. I am master in this house, and for you, controller of your fate." "The knife?" It was thrown at his feet, while she turned and fled to her room to lock the door, throw herself on her bed and break down in tears. In the hall, Henry picked up the blade and gave it to his aunt. "This can go back to where it belongs. And perhaps Cook should be told to lock it away. Now, oblige me by telling Grady I want my coach ready in half an hour." The journey into Deal left plenty of time to reflect on all the matters concerning him, not least his sister's behaviour. Was it ground to reckon her deranged, and was that a solution to keeping her under control? He was on his way to a lodge dinner, and medical coves would be there too,
One, indeed, had supplied him the drug used to subdue Elizabeth on her wedding night, never asking a question as to what it was to be used for. He would consult with the fellow, and if it seemed favourable, it might be best acted upon. What to do then about Spafford was a problem of a different nature, but he was sure a solution could be contrived. Brazier had the horses out of the stables and lined up, ready to depart, when Admiral Braddock appeared from Admiralty House, which had his inferior officer wave to prevent Dutchy and the others emerging carrying the muskets. Even if they were wrapped in canvas, their shape would give them away.
"Off somewhere, Brazier."
"Little jaunt with my old crew, sir," was the forced reply of a mind scrabbling for an excuse, the one which emerged, sounding feeble. "If it takes me far enough, I may call upon Sir Eustace."
"Long way to Bollocks, is it not?"
"We would rest the night there, sir, as I have done before."
"Well, give him my best wishes, if you do."
With that, Braddock bustled off towards the lodge and the dinner he was looking forward to attending, one in which the talk would not be exclusively nautical. Behind him, Brazier signalled to wait until he disappeared before calling the lads out. Dutchy had a long length of rope coiled round his body, while Cocky had the grappling iron, the canvas-wrapped muskets being lashed onto the saddlery. Pedler was his usual unhappy soul when it came to riding, and Joe, who was a bit scared of horses, was told to mount Canasta, which Brazier would lead. On the way back, now the plan had changed, he would double up with Dutchy. Sure that Braddock was well gone, they passed through the Navy Yard gate with a nod to the ex-tar in charge. By the time they passed Sandown Castle and hit the northern marshland, which would take them to Sandwich Flats, Admiral Braddock was on his second glass of wine. He was also deep in conversation with Henry Tulkington, wondering why the fellow kept looking over his shoulder as if seeking out someone else, until he put it down to a less than polite habit.
"Rum business, that riot the other day, Tulkington. Had to deploy some marines to make sure they never came near the yard. They're lucky to live well away from such things."
"That Brazier fellow was burnt out, I gather."
"He was, and a body found in the embers,
I heard. All on the rumour of a connection to our First Lord of the Treasury.
Balderdash, as I keep telling anyone who will listen, had to put him up at Admiralty House, so I'm seeing a bit more of him than I would strictly welcome."
"Any more on that West Indies business you were telling me about?"
"No, stuff and nonsense, probably. That said, he is an odd cove. Keeps men with him who were on his ship, which must be costing him a pretty penny. Loyal they are, too. Though only the Lord knows why he's provided them with muskets. Some nonsense about hunting rabbits, one of my officers told me."
The sudden pallor on Henry's face, Braddock put down to genuine surprise.
"Saw him going off as I came here, his men as well, I should guess, given he had all their mounts out and saddled."
Hunting rabbits? Was not really a question.
"Damn silly weapon for it," Braddock snorted. "Hitting a barn door's trouble enough with a brown bess, never mind a scurrying rabbit."
A voice from the dining room announced that dinner was about to be served, and would the gentlemen take their seats. Braddock turning to look at the sound of the voice. When he spun round again to say it might well be an idea to get a refill before going in, it was to find Henry Tulkington gone. The two lounging men, having a bit of a snooze inside his coach, got a shock to hear him yelling, even more at the rush he was in. "Get me to the slaughterhouse, now!" The lower valley road which they took was the usual mix-up of carts refusing to give way to each other and not fussy about which side they occupied. This made it a journey that had Henry thumping the opposite seat in frustration. On arrival, he leapt out and headed straight for John Hawker's upstairs office, to discover it empty. Once back on ground level, it was, "Find him!" to whoever was about, his coachman included, which sent half a dozen people to scour Deal to locate him, and when he was found, to get him to hurry back to the slaughterhouse. "Every man you can spare, John, to Cottington, and make sure they are armed." Chapter 30 Brazier did not take to Dan Spafford on first acquaintance. Mind, he had still to warm to Daisy Trotter. So when it looked as though they were going to discuss his business in front of their men, and that would include Betsy, he laid down an immediate objection.
Another room.
What are you frightened of?
Spafford demanded.
Loose talk.
Spafford shrugged and led the way to the room in which he had had occasion to lock up his son. Not that such information was vouchsafed to him. That left Dutchie, Cocky, Joe, and Pedler sharing less than pleasant glances with the Spafford gang.
I take it Trotter has told you what has happened to your boy?
Fallen on his feet by the sound of it. Mind, I expect the Tulkington bitch is too refined for his tastes.
I wouldn't go calling her a bitch, Dan.
Why not?
He grunted.
Because I might just put a ball in your skull.
Brazier spat.
That is why.
Spafford squared his shoulders as if ready for a fight.
Never met a woman who was out else.
Looking at you, I can see why.
Stop it, both of you.
Daisy pleaded.
Think on the purpose.
It took a few moments of mutual glaring before Brazier spoke. His voice tight.
As I told Daisy, I want to get my lady out and away. Then you can walk through the open gate, but not before.
You comes it high and mighty, matey.
Brazier realized he had a problem, and it was in that remark that his son had fallen on his feet. It was a stupid slip of the tongue because it implied he was thinking about money. Betsy's money. He might not stick to the agreed bargain as related by Trotter because legally it belonged to Harry. He had to keep a straight face as he gnawed on this, wondering if he would have to kidnap that sod to get what he wanted. Whatever he decided, this was not the place to make it happen. There had always been a risk he was delivering himself into the hands of some very unsavory people. But the die had been cast, and it was go forward or abort. Even that would be hard, given the numbers in this house. 4 times his own. They could just take the key Daisy knew he possessed.
I struck a bargain, which I will stick to. All I ask is that you do likewise. Am I right to assume there will be no one guarding Cottington Court?
Never is, normally, though he arms his coachman. Tulkington keeps the likes of Auger away from the house. Fear of the connection becoming too well known. Pure as snow is Henry Tulkington, and beyond the reach of the law.
He was there the last time you tried to rescue Harry.
Apney was forewarned.
Or clever enough to anticipate what you would do once he had him.
Same thing. But you won't keep them around. Set's tongues wagging, that does.
Well, it should be safe enough tonight. But I ask again, will you stick with things as they've been arranged?
That got a shrug.
Why would I not? As long as I get my Harry and a bite at Tulkington, I will rest content.
What do you have in mind for him?
Do you care?
It would not suit to have him murdered. That Brazier knew. He was too well known and seen as a pillar of the community. His death would not go unpunished. And who knew how many would get caught up in that? But there was little point in saying so. It was not in his hands.
No, I don't. You have weapons.
Brazier meant his gang. Spafford had 2 pistols in his belt, one of which he patted.
Primed and loaded. My lads have muskets.
He pulled out his watch from his waistcoat.
Time to go, then. The house should be well asleep by the time we get there.
They could have taken the Canterbury Road part way, but Spafford said that was unwise, which left them following footpaths, strange to the Brazier contingent. This killed off an idea he had to open a gap between them, for him to be there in time to get Betsy out of the house and on her way. Ideally, and originally, he wanted to pass Spafford on the way out of Cottington and be well gone before anything else happened. The notion of snatching Harry had to be abandoned. It would lead to a firefight and Betsy could be with him. If he couldn't get old man Spafford to stick to the deal, surely Betsy's own testament would be enough to ensure her assets were rendered untouchable. She didn't need them anyway. He had more than enough for them both. It was eerie, riding along with Bonnie picking her own route, bar the odd tug on the bridle. the landscape around them bathed in a not very bright silvery glow of a half-moon and starlight. It had turned cold as the warmth of the day rose into the clear night sky. There was the occasional mumble from behind him, and once or twice a curse as one of Spafford's men tripped on a hummock of grass or a tree root. There was also the feeling of being cut off from reality, one often experienced at sea, where you could sail for weeks and not sight either land or another sail. That was rendered different by the odd hooting owl, and once they got closer to Cottington and Moyle's Church, the swish of bats missing their heads by a fraction. Then the brick wall loomed up, black and forbidding, to be followed until they came to the north gate. As they dismounted, Joe took the reins to hold the horses steady, while the weapons were untied and made ready for use. Dutchy uncoiled his rope, even in near darkness having no difficulty lashing it to the grappling iron. It was then tossed skywards to grip on the top of the wall with a metallic clang that sounded as if it could be heard a mile away. Tugged until it dug into the brickwork, Cocky, the most nimble of the four, took it from his mate and pulled himself up till he could lean out and jam his feet on the wall. Then it was an upwards walk until he got a leg over the top, the grappling iron being detached and reversed. Soon even Cocky's outline was gone as he slipped down the inside. Brazier was close enough to the high wooden gates to hear the movement of the chain as he sought the padlock itself, then the slot for the key. There was an extended rattle as the chain was pulled out, and seconds later, one of the double doors opened. About to tell Spafford to wait, Brazier was nearly bowled over as the whole of his gang, their leader at the head, ran through the opening, leaving Brazier and his men to follow. There was no shouting, but a lot of cursing to no purpose. "Let's move. I don't want them getting to the house before us." He did not want to contemplate what might be the level of betrayal that had suddenly occurred. What if Spafford got to Betsy first and took her as well as his son? What would he do then? There was a pathway, and Brazier could vaguely pick out the figures in front of him, they being in no rush. He, ahead of the others, had just caught up with the last of them, entering a sort of clearing in which the sky and stars were visible, when they were suddenly surrounded by lights. Lanterns, unshaded, with others holding either a pistol or a musket. Then came an unmistakable voice, speaking as if he was simultaneously laughing. "Well, well, I seem to have caught a shell. Not just a few tiddlers, as I expected. Harry, would you believe it? Your pa has come to try and rescue you again, which I must say I did not expect. And I'm sure I spy a certain fellow who is, along with those he pays, fond of hunting rabbits when not in pursuit of wealthy widows." "How in Christ's name—" Spafford was cut off before he could finish the question, not that he was left in want of an answer. Tulkington moved out to be visible, John Hawker beside him, both with cocked pistols. "When are you going to learn that nothing happens in Deal, of which I do not know?"
"Give me my Harry and this ends, Tulkington."
"Have you asked yourself if he wants to be rescued? I assume you, Brazier, have not come on his behalf."
"Your sister is a tool in a sham marriage which I intend to expose."
"What a fine pair of fools you are." That was an accusation that hit home to Brazier. Whichever way he turned, this sod seemed to be able to humbug him. Right now he was wondering if a surrender of their weapons would suffice to get him and his men out unharmed. There was no point in continuing.
"Harry, boy," Spafford pleaded, "come away with me. We'll leave peaceful and this bugger won't dare shoot."
"Tempted as I am," Tulkington said, "the amount of explanation for so many dead bodies would be tedious. You're right, you may all leave in peace. Without your weapons, of course." He paused before turning his gaze on Brazier. "I wrote to tell you to get out of Deal, but you ignored it. If a warning followed by a narrow escape from Quebec House does not suffice, I may have to resort to other measures. My sister is not for you, and never will be.
so get away from this part of the world." There was little point in saying if he'd written a warning it had not been received, and right now it seemed Tulkington might be speaking the truth about Betsy, however hard it was to bear. "But you, Spafford, if you ever smuggle so much as a bag of tea, I will crush you. We had a bargain. You broke it."
"What say you, boy?"
Harry walked out into the pool of light, a sneer on his face.
"What, leave here? Come home. You call that hovel home? I reckon you can leave peaceful all right, but it will not be with me. Tell him, Henry, I could have walked out of here any time I wished. I ain't here 'cause I'm being held. I'm here of my own free will, and at me so."
"We're blood, Harry,"
his father pleaded, the choking sounds of tears obvious.
"You're all I got."
"More's the pity if it be true. You don't see hate when it's staring you right in the face, but I hate you. It's my fond hope I never clap eyes on you again."
With everyone looking at Dan Spafford, crestfallen and seeming to shrink as these words hit home, Daisy Trotter moved so quickly it took everyone by surprise. The fact that he'd snatched one of Spafford's pistols from his belt as well as cocked it only became obvious when it was up and aimed, the trigger pulled when he was close to Harry Spafford.
"An end to this, you ungrateful little shit."
The crash of the shot stunned everyone, but not as much as the hole that appeared in the center of Harry's forehead. His eyes opened in shock before he began to crumple, his father pulling out his second pistol, surely with the aim of killing Daisy. It was the wrong thing to do. Hawker grabbed Tulkington to drag him away as near 24 weapons spoke at once, which drowned out Daisy telling Dan he loved him. Spafford went down before he could exact revenge, but Trotter took a number of balls anyway. It hardly needed Dutchie to grab and pull at Brazier. He knew it was time to run. The blow in his shoulder as he left the clearing was like being hit by a hammer, making him stagger forward, only held up by the strength of his old coxswain. There was no time to register he'd taken a wound. They had to get mounted and away, as behind them, those who had discharged their weapons were now seeking to club each other with the stocks, to the sound of screaming imprecations. But some must be reloading, and when that was complete, they would not hesitate to shoot. Even a blind discharge could kill. They made the gate with Brazier staggering but mumbling, "Did any of you fire?" A negative chorus greeted that. Brazier was glad all replied, despite knowing he was badly wounded enough to slow them down. Even fighting for breath, he gave clear orders. "Get mounted and get away. Leave the muskets and I'll make sure you're not pursued." "Never, Captain." It took every ounce of effort he possessed to scream at them. "That's an order, Holland. Damn you, obey it."
"Gar refuse,"
Pedler shouted back.
"I won't be able to ride. You can. The shooting has begun and it won't stop."
"Wrong way round, Your Honour,"
Joe Lascelles cried out.
"Dutchie, Cocky, get him mounted."
Brazier, despite his feeble protests, was grabbed and lifted, his cries of pain ignored. They got him in the saddle and put the reins in his hands, even if he was laying over Bonnie's neck and they hung loose. Pedler smacked her rump and set her in motion, which, in a slight panic, became a very fast trot. There was no direction, and if asked, Edward Brazier would never have been able to say how long he managed to stay mounted and where his horse took him. He became delirious, talking to himself about things that made no sense. Eventually, he slid out of the saddle, one hand still gripping the reins to roll onto his back and look up at the stars, cursing all and everything. He'd fought many a battle. How could it come to this, to die in a field and not at sea? As he lay there, he heard gurgling water, a soothing sound that was close enough to wind-driven waves. With that in his ears, he closed his eyes to slide into oblivion. You've been listening to A Lawless Place. It was written by David Donaghy and read by Peter Noble.
Other recordings by David Donaghy include A Close Run Thing, The Contraband Shore, On a Particular Service. This has been a Soundings audiobook presentation. If you've enjoyed this production, please write to us at Isis House, King's Drive, Whitley Bay, Tyne and Wear, NE26 2JT, or call 0191 253 4155, or visit our website, www.isis-publishing.co.uk, and you'll be sent a full list of our recordings.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.